Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined by Jason the Mandalorian McClellan. That kind of rhymes a little bit, or at least it flows well.
It flows well, it sounds cool, but I thought we established last week that I'm on the side of the good guys, my friend.
Oh, I know, but were there any good? There were some good Mandalorians. They were good to begin with, actually, and they had the super high technology. If people don't know what we're talking about, which is probably 99% of you, Boba Fett is the most famous Mandalorian out there with at least he uses their armor and stuff. So that high tech armor that Boba Fett uses comes from the Mandalorians. But they were good to begin with. There were some good ones. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. But
And there were a whole lot of them present at the Star Wars celebration in Anaheim this past weekend. So just for protection's sake, I guess I should have befriended them.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. And that's why I brought it up, because you just came back from the Star Wars thing. And you said there was like this whole, like, you know, these huge groups of people dressed up like all these different types of characters, including 50-something group of 50-something Mandalorians.
Oh, yeah. There were lots of coordinated groups. And that's the thing with the whole Star Wars, even Star Trek, too, but the Star Wars universe. Big groups of people that belong to like clubs, and they get together and dress up. And one of the coolest things, and you would have loved it, Alejandro, because I know you love robots, the R2 builders. There were a lot of the R2-D2 builders or droid builders there actually building the robots on site, and they were even testing them out, doing little like races against each other and stuff. But fully operational R2 units are so cool to see, because some people get way into this and really build these high-tech robots. Some of them are just, you know, they've got the look down, so they'll roll and make some noises and flash some lights, but that's it. But others had them so they could push a button and like all the different compartments on R2 would open up, and the little blue flapper handy things, you know, would open up and they'd spin around and go crazy like they just got shot or something. But some of them had a lot of capabilities that were really impressive to see in person.
It's so funny you say that, because this morning I was looking at the video you took of an R2 going into an elevator, and I got so excited, because you're right. I get so excited to see remote control R2s. Ever since I was a little kid, I was like, they've got to be able to make a remote controlled ones, and that'd be so awesome. And so I do get excited about those little robot R2s, and I was thinking about that this morning when I watched your video. I thought, oh, man, there must have been a lot of really cool R2s there, because I was thinking how fun it would be to see all of that stuff, because they had models of AT-ATs and you know, what props. You had a picture of props from the new movie. Pretty exciting stuff.
They had everything there. Mm-hmm. Everything from the Star Wars universe was there.
Pretty cool. Well, welcome
back. Yeah, it was
back.
A lot of fun. Well, thank you. Back to the real world.
Back to the real world and UFOs, baby. So I guess I'll let people know, first of all, the person we're interviewing today. I'm going to interview Jennifer Stein, and she is a UFO documentary filmmaker, and she has won several EBE awards at the UFO Congress, the EBE Film Festival being our UFO Film Festival at the Congress. It's the only, I think, UFO Film Fest. And if it's not, you know, given how we follow the news on everything, if we don't know about it, it's probably not very big. And ours is pretty big. So We get a lot of great films, and Jennifer has made some good ones. The latest one she made was one called Travis, about Travis Walton, and she did a lot of interviews. It's a great documentary, and it won the best long form film, and it also won the People's Choice. So she walked away with 2 out of the 3 awards at the film festival this year. So it did very well. So we're gonna talk to her about how she got involved with all of this, how she started making UFO films, and behind the scenes of the Travis Walton film. So this will be a lot of fun. But before we do that, of course, Jason and I are going to talk to you about the UFO news of the week, of which there is quite a bit this week, really, I think, going on out there. What story did you want to talk about, Jason?
Well, I just want to bring attention to a quick story here about our good friend Chuck Zukowski, whom you've had on this show many times. There's a movie being made about Chuck. This is pretty exciting. So this news just broke last week that UFO and paranormal investigator Chuck Zukowski, who's largely known for his work with investigating animal mutilations, but he investigates UFOs and all sorts of paranormal stuff. So he was approached, somebody found out about Chuck through his various work he does, and wanted to do a book about him. So there is going to be a novel, supposedly, about Chuck Zukowski and his work. But through this, New Line, and many of you are probably familiar with New Line, they're a very major film company, they picked up this story for a feature film adaptation. So in the works is a feature film about Chuck Zukowski and his incredible findings of alien sightings, cattle mutilations, and all sorts of stuff. And it's focused on this idea that Chuck's talked about for a few years now about the 37th degree of latitude. Chuck likes to call this the paranormal high or paranormal freeway. Is that what he calls it? I never
I
remember if he
forgot
calls it
something like
paranormal
that.
freeway or paranormal highway. But what Chuck did was he was looking at sightings and looking for similarities. UFO sightings, animal mutilations, sites of strange happenings, and found that there was an interesting pattern, a straight line across the country, basically, across the United States, where strange things were happening. And it's along the 37-degree latitude line. So he's got this idea that he's been talking about for years, about this 37-degree latitude line, or the paranormal freeway. And he even notes that Area 51 happens to fall on that line or near that line. So it's interesting. We've talked about this idea before, talked to Chuck about it, but it's getting attention from other people, and it looks like there's going to be a major motion picture about Chuck and his findings.
Yeah, so funny because his sister, who's a really cool lady, and I could do a plug, I guess. She asked me to do a Skype interview for her MUFON group, but she's Debbie Ziegelmeyer. She's a state director in Missouri, and also a MUFON board member. I know there are a lot of sightings and stuff going on in Missouri. They've had these really crazy flaps out there. We've had her on and her assistant director, and we've talked about those. And then he lives in Colorado, and they're both along the 37th parallel. And so they found all of these things, and now it's so funny, they're doing a movie about it. Kind of cool, and it was picked up by New Line, so I'm sure it's be partially based on his actual research, but also probably largely based on some stuff they make up for fun. But pretty interesting. How weird they would pick up on something like this.
Yeah, it is weird, but I'm glad they did, and it'll be really interesting to see what they do with it. I think you're right. I think it will be more fiction than truth, but at least based on his findings, we'll see how close they get or how much reality they choose to put into it. But it'll be fun. So good for Chuck.
He's going to have a lot of fun, I'm sure.
Oh.
He's going to be a consultant. He'll probably be on the set. So it's
Yep.
probably going to be a lot of fun for him. And we'll see which actors they choose once they get to that stage, which hopefully they do. Hopefully it all happens.
Chuck is a character.
Yeah, that's for sure.
They should throw him in because
I know. I mean,
he is
he
pretty
goes
zany.
by the UFO Nut. So UFONut.com, in fact, is where you can find out more about him. So a couple
It's
stories real quick. I just wanted to say something. You did the follow-up, but on the 14th of what, February and March, there were UFO sightings in Bakersfield, California, and they were covered by the local news out there. And then, so we're all looking forward to, was it going to happen in April? April 14th came across, and there was a UFO video that was posted. However, I don't know what you think, Jason. I think those other two videos from February or March were actually pretty interesting because, you know, that one of them was this blue light, and which it's hard to figure out what that might have been. But this latest photo is not as mysterious.
Yep, that's right. And I think, you know, it might have been covered because people were looking for that UFO sighting in Bakersfield on the 14th again to happen. Yeah, I agree with you. Not as exciting as the first two. And as I said in the story, this one is most likely an airplane, but we can't be sure. And with those blue ones, they were interesting, but not much detail to really see much of the object itself. But those were more interesting. And who knows, there could have been another blue UFO or something that happened on the 14th of April. We just haven't heard about it yet. But yeah, interesting. 3 months in a row, three UFO sightings in Bakersfield. But that's not uncommon. I mean, if you look at UFO sightings, you could probably pick that out for any city in America. UFO sightings are everywhere, people.
So, and they happen on a nearly daily basis, especially someplace like California where there's a lot of sightings. But
That's right.
those first two, at least that blue UFO that they had, I think is really interesting. I can't figure out what that might have been. I guess possibly a drone or something, but pretty interesting video.
Agreed.
Another interesting video was one over Tijuana. It was covered in the Mexican news, but they didn't cover it very thoroughly. So it was this site called Cadena News, which is chain news in Mexico. And they wrote about, they said that the people saw these UFOs over Tijuana and they posted videos on social networking. So they posted them on their site. And that's about it. That's the only info. And they have these two videos that they posted, and there's no details. They don't say who posted them. They don't give you links to the social networking place wherever they posted them. They don't say when. They don't put any information, which is kind of frustrating because this is a news reporter. He should have put in at least some details about, you know, who posted it, when and where, but nothing. So, but of course, you know, people have been kind of excited about it and interested in it. The video, does show something pretty cool looking. I think, I don't know, it kind of seems like a balloon with LEDs or probably a kite with LEDs. But of course, just like any of these kites and stuff with LEDs, they look pretty remarkable and they look really neat.
They
So,
do, and I agree that that's most likely what it is. We've seen this stuff before, especially in Latin America. We've seen some pretty impressive LED kite rigs put together that kind of wobble like that one does and has the changing lights. So most likely what it is, but it's hard to tell. And you're right, the reporting was pretty bad on
They
it.
could have given a lot more information, but unfortunately they didn't. Finally, just a couple kind of astrobiological things that I wanted to talk about. First of all, just to clarify, you know, we did this story on these FRBs, FBRs. Now I can't remember what they are. Anyway, these
Fast
signals.
radio burst.
Yeah, fast radio bursts. These signals that they've been getting that they thought might be extraterrestrial. However, you know, they have determined that they are periodic, which and relate to a number, which is why they think they might be artificial. They think they might be humans. But a story has come out that they've mistaken these alien signals when they're actually from a microwave. And so everybody keeps posting, oh, they debunked that. That was a microwave. No, guys, that is not the case. Just like usual, people aren't reading the details of the story, and the headlines are completely not accurate. They're making you think that something there's not. So there was a signal, a different type of signal that people were getting that they couldn't identify. And that was from, they found out to be microwaves. But it wasn't the FRBs. The FRBs are not from the microwaves. All of the stories, if you read them, state that it's not the FRBs, it's some other kind of signal. So just so people know, FRBs aren't totally determined, but they did find out they fit the UTC time code, which means that even more likely that they're possibly human, though. And I guess finally, I think this is exciting. These scientists published their findings. I think this is really important, where they looked for radiation and extra heat coming from different galaxies, because they figured, just like us, we generate a lot of heat with our electronics and everything. So they were thinking it could be possible then that a galaxy emitting heat. But what these scientists have done is that they looked at the radiation from these galaxies. They were able to, because the WISE, W, I forget what the acronym means, but it's this satellite that NASA has up there, is able to do that. So they looked at all of the data. They were able to comb through the data of over 100,000 galaxies to determine if there's enough heat radiating from it that it could indicate there's an artificial intelligence. And they didn't find, and this is kind of silly too, because some stories are saying the search found no evidence, there's no aliens out there, which is an overstatement. And then some other places are saying they found 50 galaxies where there could be aliens, which is not necessarily an overstatement, actually, and is actually more accurate, even though, of course, they're trying to make it sound more exciting. But they did find elevated levels in 50 different galaxies, and there were actually 90, there were 40 other anomalies that they noted. So they say there's 90 things out there they found that they want to take a closer look at. And those 50 galaxies emitting more radiation are possibly, possible from advanced civilizations. Now, they did say they didn't find what they were looking for. They were looking for a civilization which is called a Type 3 civilization. I kind of detail it in the story here, where you can find out what they mean by that. But this is a civilization that's using massive amounts of power, where they're using all of their sunlight, harnessing the energy from all of the sunlight from all of the suns in their galaxies. That's the type of civilization they did not find. And of course, they're saying that's assuming that an advanced civilization would do that, and we don't know that they would do that whatsoever. So it's certainly not conclusive that there are no advanced civilizations out there in these 100,000 galaxies, like a lot of the news is reporting. They did find something interesting, and I think it's a really cool, interesting study. It was something that's exciting, because what if they did find, something more conclusive? And now that they've found a few galaxies, it gives us somewhere to look, and they may find something still.
It's one approach. It's a worthwhile approach.
Yeah.
And as you said, there are many other possibilities. So the people, all the story that are just dismissing it, saying, "Oh yeah, they looked and found nothing, so therefore no aliens." Really frustrating. But this is
Yeah.
just one thing, one way they can look. And again, we talk about this in the search for life as we know it. That's one approach, looking for the only data point we have, us. But there are so many other possibilities. Would subterranean life out there emit all of this stuff that we would be able to see? Probably not. So it's interesting. It's just one thing to look at. And they did, as you pointed out, they did find interesting things in this study. So keep pushing on, guys. Keep pushing on.
Exactly. Keep looking. And thanks for looking. That's awesome. It's a great study, though. I really recommend that people read up on it. So all of that, and some other really cool sighting reports from MUFON by Roger Marsh at the website at openminds.tv. So there's the news. Any more news you wanted to talk about, Jason?
That's all the news, Alejandro.
All right, then let's talk with Jennifer Stein. I am very happy to have on the show Jennifer Stein. Hello.
Hi, Alejandro. Thank you so much for having me. What an honor and a treat.
Yeah, well, it's great to talk like this, because of course we see each other often at different events, and we talk occasionally, but I've never, even though we've got to talk, about different things here and there, I've never got the chance to sit down with you and kind of talk with you about how you got into this and why. And so I'm really excited to talk about that.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
So you have won many EBE awards. How many, actually?
Actually, it's four, and it's been a real honor. Now, it's only for two films.
Okay.
But I've been lucky enough to win both sets of your awards when I have won awards.
Wow.
So won both the best, you know, long form documentary and also the People's Choice Award, which are both these lovely little Ebby statues. So
yeah.
I should have four sitting around in my office, but I gave one of them away this year to Travis, because without Travis's story and without me having the opportunity to make his story and him trusting me, of course, I wouldn't have had one. So I have a new one on order, I think, from Angela, but we have to follow up with that.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Well, that was really nice of you. And, you know, for us, I think we're out and we have to get a new batch because they're really hard to make. They're molded, like, perfectly to our – we have, like, a master, and we have to send it out to someone to create out of metal and all this stuff, and we order batches usually. So we'll get one to you. We have a bent-up one, unfortunately, in the office. Somehow it got broken. But
well, those are – they bend easily. I have shipped them across the country a couple times, and they do bend very easily. So I get it.
Yeah. Well, so that is really cool. And, I mean, that's like a grand slam for your two movies because just so people know, everybody who's been nominated, because we have the two core categories, the short form and the long form – anybody who's been nominated is eligible for the People's Choice. Now, I like it when, and this is certainly no slight to your movie, it's always a lot of fun when one of the people who didn't win one of the other awards wins the People's Choice, because then there's more winners.
Of course.
When a movie does win both, that's like a grand slam. You got two grand slams.
I got two grand slams, yeah. And
nice.
I was especially honored this year because there were lots of good filmmakers this year. I think the first year I won, maybe there weren't really a lot of good films.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, sometimes you get fabulous, excellent films, and other years they're kind of mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a very unique genre.
Right.
When you go to Google, like as a filmmaker, if you go to apply to a film festival and you want to apply to a UFO film festival, when you type in UFO film festival with Without a Box or, you know, filmfestivals.com or whatever, your film festival is the only one that pops up.
Mm-hmm.
There are no other film festivals like yours. It's a very unique genre. And, I mean, there's other paranormal festivals, but you specifically at your conference draw together a group of people who are knowledgeable and concerned about this issue, many experiencers. Plus, it's all your presenters can go and see these films. And,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, I know there's a group of judges that come in the day before, but the People's Choices Award is awarded from the thousands of people that come to your conference. So that's an incredible honor because they're a very educated group.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't pull the wool over their eyes. Or if
Good
you do
point.
Something on film that just really doesn't cut it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really come off. And so I was really honored this year to mm-hmm. be acknowledged amongst all the amazing speakers you had and all the amazing other filmmakers and the audience who was there.
Mm-hmm.
Every year it grows and grows. And this year being your fifth year there at the it's not called the Fort McDowell Hotel anymore. It's called the Wecopa Hotel.
I almost called it Fort McDowell. I keep calling it that. But you're right. But it's the Wecopa.
It's the Wecopa Resort, but it's on Fort McDowell Boulevard, and it's, of course, in this lovely reservation.
Yavapai.
Is that what it is? Yavapai?
Yavapai.
Yavapai. Okay. Well, it's just a lovely space, and I am so honored to go there, and your conference has continued to grow every year you've been there, and I think this was the most amount of people you ever had.
Yeah, it was. It was a fun one. Like you said, it always grows. I love those words too. Wecopa and Yavapai. They're cool words. But you're right. Some years are better than others, the film quality. I don't remember when you won last time what the rest of the films were like. But this year, the competition was really really stiff. I mean, there were some really good films. I mean, I had Jeremy Corbell on the other day. Unfortunately, his debut, he didn't win any awards. But I love his films. I think they're great. There was the one Magic, or no, something
Patient,
about...
Patient? Was it Patient 17?
Patient 17, yeah.
I think he had two films this year.
Yeah, and then we had Mark Pilkington. I think his was great. We had these Maury Alley Island guys. Who did, so there were a lot of really good films, and but yours, you know, the People's Choice was a close one. I can let you know that.
Okay.
But so that's good, which is a good thing. You know, that means you had some good competition and you won out from the competition. But people just – it was certainly a fan favorite. People were so excited about the film, and I think even if they didn't vote for your film, they still loved it. And we're happy that you won, and I think, you know, because everybody, I think, has it at the conference, has a place in their heart for Travis, and you did a great job. Maybe the best job anybody's done on a Travis documentary, probably, on putting together, you know, how people have felt and how this has touched their lives, the witnesses and Travis, and even people like the guy who did the polygraph test.
Yes, yes. It was quite a journey. It really was. Working on it, it was like 5 years total from when I met Travis and really got to know him. Our mutual friend Peter Robbins introduced us, and I always thought in the back of my mind, boy, wouldn't it be neat to be able to do a film about Travis? But I didn't know I had it in me. And it took more than I thought I had, as most films do. They're like birthing something brand new. And it came from a couple of other projects. Like we didn't start making out this documentary. When we started, we were just making a movie for his 38th or 39th annual conference. The 38th didn't really happen, although we were planning it. The 39th kind of happened by the hair of our chinny chin chin. But what Travis envisioned was being able to take people to the site in the forest and kind of do not like a reenactment, but like a walkthrough. This is where the truck stopped. This is where I ran up the hill. This is where the craft was hovering in this canopy of the trees. He really wanted to give people that one-on-one time with himself. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know if it was going to snow or rain or be freezing. And also to get a large group of people to the forest in the dark, it's very risky. Mm-hmm. And I said, Travis, let's do a virtual experience in the woods with you and the other men describing what happened, because we just might not be able to get there. You know, when the conference. So it started out as a virtual tour of the forest. And then once we got that done, then I was like, well, I didn't think I could do that. And I did that. Maybe we could just shoot a bunch of interviews with some people and experts and people who were involved. Like, can we find any of them? Like, is the sheriff still alive? Is the polygrapher still alive? So then the hunt began for the real meat and dirt of the story, you know. And once I started to acquire some of those interviews, which was about 2 years ago, then I knew I had something. And it was just a matter of really being able to put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was involved. I mean, it was over my head. I involved a lot of talented people. I don't think even if I started tomorrow, I could have done this film on my own by myself. I used some editors in L.A. that took about a four-hour film and helped me focus it in. And they read the book, they took the meat of the story, and they very tightly edited it in a way that I had not edited it, but it was better. And then I went, wow, now we've got something happening. And then I hired a musician. So, you know, I'm not the perfect filmmaker, but I am becoming an executive producer that can make good films.
Cool.
Because you can't know how to do everything. Every editing program has a menu and it's complicated. Every sound sweetening thing, every new version of Photoshop or, you know, whatever has complicated menus, and you have to know how to work them, and motion and text. And,
but I think that's a good thing, because it indicates growth, because only really independent, smaller productions are one-man shows. Most documentaries, you know, have huge, or films especially, but even bigger documentaries, you know, have a lot of people working on them. So you're still a filmmaker. You're just, like becoming a producer and learning how to work with a team and becoming able to produce better productions.
That's right. And had I tried to do it all myself, it might have taken me 10 years. But because I had some resources I had saved up for this project, and because I've developed a lot of friends who are professionals in the field, I was able to tap them and say, can you do this part? Can you do that part? And, of course, it's continuing on as well. We're working on a new version of the film. And partly that's out of desire, and partly it's out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the archive footage we have, I was only able to license permission to use it in film festivals and use it in free screenings, but I'm not able to
actually. Oh, you're kidding.
No, it was sort of a miscommunication. Maybe I take responsibility for it, but it caught me by surprise. I used some footage from a production called UFOs Are Real that Stanton Friedman had guided me to. Stanton was one of my interviewers, of course, and Stanton came and interviewed Travis in 1978. Actually, as part of this documentary, I think that's the first time he met Travis. A film producer named Brandon Chase and his wife Marianne Chase did a fabulous production in 1978, and they really didn't sell it much. It's still available on eBay. You can find it. A few people have old, you know, copies of it, and it's been transferred to DVD and available for sale now. But they took three main stories, and they went into depth on them. One was Roswell. One was the Betty and Barney Hill story, and the third was the Travis Walton story. And Wendell Stevens is in this production. Uh-huh. It's really a great production. I really love what Wendell has to say in the end of it. I mean, I can't say enough about how fabulous it is. So I, through Stanton, contacted the Chases, who are still alive. They're 85 and 80, and they live in Hollywood, California. And I contacted them in the end of November, the beginning of December, and said, you know, Stanton sent me a copy of this production that he helped write and produce with you in 78, and I'm doing a film about Travis. I'd like to license the footage from you. And their first reaction and response was, we will work with you in any way we can. And gradually, as the holidays came on and as I tried to get a contract signed and written, it got a little more confusing, and they started to backpedal. They did agree to let me use the footage, and when I finally sent them my contract and my check, which was right before the holidays, I didn't hear from them. So I continued editing. I used the footage. I sent you my DVD by the 15th of January. And on that day, on the 15th of January, Marianne Chase called me up and said, well, we've changed our mind.
Oh, no.
And you can't use our footage. And I was literally kind of up the creek. So my good friend and former co-producer on the Disclosure Dialogues named Ron James, Ron wasn't going to take no for an answer. And long story short, he basically knocked on the Chase's door, offered them another check, and offered to sit down and handwrite a contract with them, which they reluctantly sort of agreed to do, but they did because they kind of, you know, they kind of had me over a barrel. I didn't want to pull the film. I wanted to show it, and I wanted to show it because I thought it might win, and I wanted a year's worth of screenings of this film to build up the awareness and the, you know, interest in Travis's conference for this coming November, because this November will be the 40th anniversary. And I wanted people to know about it and begin to say, wow, it's been 40 years and look where we are. You know, I mean, the topic is still ridiculed. And look at the evidence to Travis's story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of unrefutable evidence. Because we don't know exactly what happened to him while he was on the craft. That's the big mysterious part. You know, but we know Travis wasn't asleep in the forest. We know that if he'd gotten up and walked away, those dogs would have found his tracks. You know, he was probably on board this craft and missing, even though we can't prove it. But as you come around to looking at facts and trying to figure out if a story is real or not, His story has all the evidence to stand up in a court of law. Between the lie detector tests and, you know, the 500 people looking for him and the hounds smelling his scent, trying to smell a scent and not finding it. It's just too good to be true. So that's why I wanted to tell the true story and begin to open other people's minds as well in mainstream film festivals. I mean, it's wonderful that the UFO community embraced this film, but I'm wondering if they'll embrace it like at the Philadelphia Film Festival or, you know, the Ashland Film Festival. So it's now in the process of being accepted. I'm using Without a Box, which is a film festival program where you literally send your film via files or Dropbox, or you load it into what's called IMDb, which a lot of Hollywood movies are loaded into, and you find where what categories you're good for, and then you send it off. So it's been accepted in about 10 different festivals, and I'm scrambling to get it into some more just to see how it does against other documentaries that are true life story documentaries, but not quite as maybe as much of a phenomenon as Travis's is.
So what'll be great is and so people know, it's not like you rely on this UFOs are real footage a lot. It's not like
it's 4 minutes of footage in a 90-minute piece. It's only 4 minutes. But as you understand, unless I have clear rights to be able to screen this film in say movie theaters to pay for, you know, to have people paying tickets to see it, I'm probably not going to make back the outlay that I laid out to make this film. And filmmakers seek to do that so that I can make the next project. The other way to make back your money is to, 'cause some awards, you know, some film festivals give you awards, and some of those are cash awards, which is nice. But I'm hoping that once it wins a few more awards, I can sell it to a network. And that's where you can begin to make back your money, selling it to some cable networks or some mainstream networks like Sci-Fi or History Channel, and then doing international distributions in other countries, maybe, you know, subtitling it and translating it into different languages. I already have some interest from Brazil and from France, from some of my other friends, my UFO friends in other countries, that they would very much be interested in helping me. I have a friend in Turkey who wants to, and she does voiceovers and translations for films. That's what she does for a living. Udozo. She's very interested.
I didn't know she did that.
Excited. Yes, that's what she did in Turkey before she came to the States. And she's, of course, returned to Turkey. And we've stayed in touch, and I've been there to see her, and she's been back here a couple times, and we've maintained our friendship. And, yeah, I'm very excited.
And just so people know, Farah is like a Turkish UFO researcher.
Yes, she is. And she's written a book. I think it's Confessions of a Turkish Psychic or something like that. She's got a long list of psychic experiences in her family and UFO experiences in her family going back several generations.
Pretty interesting. So people who are listening to the show who don't know much about Travis Walton's case, like most do, but some might not. I guess just in a nutshell real quick, and of course, people will just have to. I've interviewed him so many times, and he's been on the show a lot, so people can go look for those. But yeah, he was a logger in what, 1975?
Correct.
And him and his buddies, at the end of one night working late, saw a light in the forest. They thought was a fire in the forest. They went over.
Or a plane crash.
Or they a plane it was crash.
A plane crash.
So they went over to take a look. They see this UFO. Travis, like a knucklehead, gets out and runs over to it. He changes his mind and decides he better get back. Of course, his coworkers are like, "You idiot, get back here." It takes off, and there's this beam of energy that throws him back. His buddies freak. They think he's dead. They take off. They eventually come back to get him after they get up their nerve, and he's gone. And they go to the police, say a UFO took our buddy. The police don't believe him. They think maybe they killed him, but there's a big manhunt. 5 days later, Travis ends up on the side of the road. He thought he was only gone a few hours. He calls his family. They come pick him up, take him to Tucson, I think. to hide him out because the press and everybody was all over this thing. Everybody took lie detector tests to show that, you know, there was no foul play, that they were telling the truth, that they saw this UFO, and then Travis disappeared. And then eventually, after regression, Travis had some trauma, and he remembered meeting these weird characters and being on board a craft. And when he came back, he saw this craft take off above his head. So
that's right. That's right. And I think just to add to your description, mm-hmm. Travis remembered everything when he woke up on the side of the road. He never had to be regressed to remember things like a lot of people. He needed to be regressed to get a handle on the traumatic stress he was experiencing, because he was also terribly dehydrated. He'd lost almost 12 pounds. He hadn't had anything to eat or drink in 5 days. And that added to the stress. He was in an extremely weakened condition. And his brother did protect him. His older brother, Dwayne, realized that the media and the press were going to be all over him, because they were all over their family and they were all over the work crew. And the reason the work crew took the lie detector test before Travis was returned, they took the tests on Sunday, and Travis was returned Sunday night. He went missing on a Wednesday, and by Sunday, they called off the search for him because they couldn't find him. 5 days had gone by. They decided to give all these boys lie detector tests because they didn't believe him, and they didn't expect them to pass, and they all passed the test. And then that night, Travis was returned. Mm-hmm. And Travis himself eventually went under some lie detector tests. Not right away, but eventually he did. And he passed them. He's passed over 5 lie detector tests, as well as a number of the other boys. So when you pass one test, that's significant. When you have 7 people passing one test, that's astronomical. When you have 7 people passing 7 tests, that's, you know, the exponential proportion of significance that has is huge. It's like mm-hmm. way off the charts.
Yeah.
You know, you can't fake a story for 40 years and continue to pass lie detector tests. And that's what's the basis behind Travis's story.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about some other stuff, and we're already running out of time.
Okay.
And I think what we should do is have you back to talk more about Travis's case in the film, specifically, maybe in a couple months.
I would love that.
One more thing I do want to say about Travis and his case, and you mentioned this earlier, is that they had there was a 39th anniversary event. It was called the Skyfire Summit. There's going to be a 40th anniversary event. And like you talked about, how exciting it would be, and the idea of getting out there with Travis and some of the witnesses in the location. And this is something that's really exciting about the 40th, is that during the day now, people will be able to go out there and hang out with Travis on the anniversary of where this all took place until, you know, the sun goes down. So at the same time that it all took place, I'm super excited about this.
That's right. Yeah. Hopefully we'll be leaving the forest around 6, just about the time they were leaving the forest.
Yeah.
And we have just enough time to get out of the forest before the sun sets.
Yeah.
When it does, it is pitch black. And if there's no moon,
cold,
you can't see.
Last year we were out there in the middle of the night, and it was so cold that people couldn't really take too much
and couldn't
spend too much time out there. So that's exciting. But what else is exciting is then people, because right now, like you said, people can't really see the film unless you go to a film festival. They're going to be able to see it at this event as well.
Yes, they are. Now, they can buy it from my website. If they go to On Wings Productions, I have set up a PayPal click and buy, and I'm using eBay so that people can put in their own shipping. You know, if they want it UPS or they want it postal service, or depending on where they live and what part of the world, they can pay for it to be shipped to them. And I am selling DVDs that way right now, but that's really the only way to see it. Mm-hmm. But there are screenings happening all over. It's amazing. There are 4 in Canada this week, and there's some in Australia, cool. Hawaii. Mexico, London, Scotland, and a whole bunch all over the United States with UFO conferences. It's going to be Contact at the Desert. It's going to be at the MUFON International Symposium in September. It'll be in the Paradigm Conference in Minneapolis. So it's amazing. People are just, you know, begging me to let them screen the film, and I'm really very, very happy to do it. I'm asking for a small screening fee, which is typical of, you know, filmmakers, just to kind of have permission to show it in a large scale. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like buying tickets to see it. I mean, the conference coordinators are coordinating that. So I'm still within the bounds of my kind of crazy handwritten contract. But we hope to have a new film, too, in maybe by the time of Travis's conference, which will have these reenactments in it. And I sent you a whole bunch of pictures.
Yeah.
If you decide you want to post them, or when we do our next interview, we can talk more in depth about what version 2 will be, because I'll take out the chase footage because they won't give me rights to use it. I'll replace it with other footage, and we'll have more in-depth reenactments of what happened on board the craft.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So that's really exciting. Yeah, I'll post one of these pictures of a reenactment. And I see you in a mask. Are you going to, like, have a cameo in this?
I actually have a cameo, yes, myself and my good friend Veronica, and some of the camera crew are playing doctors, because when Travis woke up on board the craft, he thought he was in a hospital, and he thought he saw doctors around him with, like, white hats, and the bottoms of their faces tended to not be there, and he thought, well, maybe they had face masks on. So we went to Goodwill, and we went to a medical supply place, and we found, you know, outfits, and we dressed ourselves up. So we're going to have our bodies, you know, morph into the scenes on board the craft. In fact, I could probably send you. I have to find one more picture. I think it's just on my phone. We're doing CGI. So we shot against a green screen, and we are inserting these aliens that, you know, basically took him off the craft. For some reason, I'm not finding them in my photo file here, but maybe I have them somewhere else. I have to find them. I'll send them to you.
Cool.
But it's really very interesting what we're able to accomplish with green screen.
How fun. It sounds like a lot of fun. You just had some screenings, and Travis out there where you live, right, in New York just this weekend?
Oh, yes, we did. Travis was here, and he spoke in New Jersey. Then he went up to New York. Peter Robbins met him there, and they spoke for the Intruders Foundation. Peter was very involved with Bud Hopkins when he was still alive with this group. But since Bud's been gone, you know, they really haven't met. So this was the perfect opportunity to bring them together. And so he spoke there. They screened the film. And then he took a train down to Philly, and he spoke for my local group that I've been running called Mainline MUFON. For 15 years, I've been bringing free public programming to my public library. So he came, and we had a packed house. I mean, I think the library was freaking out that, like, never had this many people showing
up.
Wow. And by the way, I just found these other photos, and I've also sent them to you so you can see our aliens on green screen and our costume as it developed a little bit.
I saw the human-type aliens there. Wow, cool.
Yeah, there so they there's are. There's our actor. We hired an actor that looked pretty much like Travis.
Uh-huh.
And we even built a hallway for him to walk around.
Oh,
and we
did
it from behind. It was a paper hallway, but you'd never know it the way we shot it. So because Travis explained light coming through the walls, mm-hmm. So we lit it from behind. So
how cool.
The walls lit up. Yeah, we did this all on such a budget you can't imagine.
Wow.
But we're hoping that it really comes off well, and I think it really will.
Yeah, exciting. So much fun. So getting on to something else I wanted to ask you about. So I think the first EBE awards you won were for your Disclosure Dialogues.
Correct. That was in 2012 with Ron James.
Was that the first your first film?
Not really. Uh-huh. If you go to my website, or anyone can go to On Wings Productions, you can see I've done – I've been making films for almost 20 years, but I really wasn't doing it as professionally as I've now started to. I was tapped to do things for schools and synagogues and charities, and I was an event decorator, so I used to do weddings and bar and bat mitzvahs and corporate parties, and I started to film those events for my own advertising purposes to sell the next event. And then people said, well, could you give me a copy of the film? And then I started editing the footage for them. And before you know it, I was doing the decorating and the filming for their events. So then kind of decided I really didn't want to do wedding and bar and bat mitzvah films. I wanted to do real life story films. And I was shooting my children, you know, I was doing, you know, all sorts of fun projects. I would do yoga retreats. I did film work for Zachariah Sitchin. I did women's spirituality retreats. So there's a lot of, like a friend of mine was killed in a terrorist bus attack in Israel, and I made a film about her that's called Rita's Journey. I made that in 1990, and the film went around the world, raised $100,000, and opened a legal aid bureau in her memory. And it serves Arab women, Druze women, Palestinian women, women who are abused. It's kind of like a peace center and a legal aid bureau in Carmel, Israel. So that film is on my website. People can go and look at my history of filmmaking. But I definitely got into it through the back door. I did not go to film school. I am an entrepreneur and an artist. I've designed and produced clothing. I've been a painter. I've studied crop circles. I kind of dabble in a lot of things. But my problem is I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So, I end up learning an awful lot and learning to a professional level where then I can do what I'm doing professionally. So that's kind of how I got into filmmaking.
How cool. So, and when did you first get into then UFOs?
Well, I had my own experience when I was 19, which you probably don't know about.
No.
But it stayed in my gray box for about 25 years because I couldn't decipher if it was a dream or if it was real. And when I was about 45, I realized that I wasn't alone at the time. Someone who was a dear friend of mine who was in my parents' house at the same time at 5:30 in the morning saw the same thing I saw. It was a large craft, about a 90-foot craft that was less than 500 feet from my bedroom window. When I realized that he experienced the same thing I experienced and we never talked about it,
wow.
That was when I was about 45. So that was, I'm 60 now. So that was about, 15 years ago? That's when I really decided, all right, either I'm going to step fully forward and allow myself to, you know, or give myself permission, you know, step through the ridicule, start to research this, figure out what it meant, figure out what happened to me, what happens to other people, what does this mean? Are we alone in the universe? And of course, it opened so many doors and windows. I started reading in a grander scale things that I would not have read before. I read all of Zachariah Sitchin's books and started to study with him. And I, you know, it was just a whole new door opened for me. And I became very good with some fabulous people, did a lot of film work for Zachariah, became good friends with Peter Robbins and with, of course, Stanton Friedman and Rich Dolan. In 2008, I almost produced a piece that was sold for Sci-Fi as an episodic television show called First Contact. And it was right around the time when UFO Hunters was coming out. And it was also around the time when Sci-Fi went through a bankruptcy. So they greenlighted our project and then promptly went bankrupt and nothing ever happened of it. But we did have it posted on the website for a long time. Online on YouTube. It was called First Contact. And it was going to be Stanton Friedman, Rich Dolan, and Peter Robbins riding around in a UFO. I mean, not a UFO. Riding around in a...
That'd be cool.
That's what Ron James is doing now. He's riding around in a UFO shooting for iVolve TV. But we were going to ride around in an RV all around the country and check out these incredible UFO stories. And we shot an episode in Washington, D.C., covering the 1952 and the 2002 sightings, which were almost 50 years to the day. And that was our first episode. And it did well. I mean, we really did a great little, we did a teaser for the production. We actually produced a small show and then we posted the teaser online And Sci-Fi really liked it, and so did Larry Lansman. But we were never able to come fully to, full circle on that. So that was about 2 years before I did the Disclosure Dialogues with Ron.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And you've been involved with MUFON for quite some time as well, right?
Yes, I have. I was literally asked locally. I had been already doing programs about crop circles and UFOs at my local library. I started that right around the one-year anniversary of 9/11 in 2002. In fact, September 11th, 2002 was my first program. And I did it to be of service to the community because I thought there was things that weren't being shared in the major media. And I won't get into a discussion about 9/11. That's really not my main topic of expertise at all. But I felt that if I gave people some other interesting things to learn, no matter what the topic was, whether it was health and wellness or UFOs or crop circles or ancient civilization, ancient architecture, ancient mounds throughout the United States, there's so many things to learn about. And so I'm now, I've done this for 15 years. We just we'll be starting our 15th year in September. And every month I do a free program. And that's, of course, what Travis came in to speak at just this month. So it was a real coup for me to have standing room only at the library. We may have to find another venue if it continues to grow. But we had about 120 people there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so then getting back to the Disclosure Dialogues, I guess, explain what that was and how that came about.
Well, Ron... I was at the last International UFO Congress that happened in Lachlan, Nevada, before John Rau got involved and brought it to Phoenix and created Open Minds. So while I was there, Danny Sheehan came up to me, who knew I did film work, and he said, I'd really like you to shoot an interview for me with Rich Dolan. I've never met him. Will you introduce me? I'd love to sit down and talk to him, and I'd love to have it videotaped. And I said to Danny, well, I won't say no, but I'm here as a guest. I only came with my suitcase. I live in Philadelphia. All my lights and tapes and cameras and mics and cables and whatnot are in Philly. I don't have a single thing here with me except my little, you know, Epson, you know, still camera that can shoot video, but, you know, only 10 minutes at a time. So I said, but I won't say no. I'll see what can happen. And I'm standing there thinking about, well, how can I do this? Like, you know, what can I rent equipment? Can I call around town? What's here in Lachlan? And at that moment, the camera I own walked in front of me at eye level. And it was Ron James, who I didn't know, walking by me with the same camera I owned in Philly, which was
funny.
A very high end, a very expensive, like a $7,000, you know, HD, you know, Canon camera. So I just started to follow him. I was like, well, what am I going to say? Well, you know, how am I going to ask this guy to like borrow probably $30,000, $40,000 worth of equipment? If he's here with a camera, maybe he's shooting, maybe he's set up in a room. Like, he doesn't know me from Adam. He's not going to say yes. What am I going to do? And I finally just said, well, God help me. And I tapped him on the shoulder and he turned around and I said, can I like basically borrow everything you own, you know? And he said, well, who are you and why are you asking? So I followed him up to his room. I saw his setup. He to check out of the hotel like in 10 minutes. He was leaving to drive back to LA. And he said, well, no, I have to leave. I can't afford another room, another night. You know, I have to get back to LA. I said, well, how about I pay your room? And I buy, you know, I rent your equipment or whatever. He said, you pay my room and that's all you need. I'll sell you a tape. And so he helped me shoot this interview. And it was such a good interview that he turned to me and said, well, what do you intend to do with this, Jen? And I said, well, actually, I hadn't even thought about that. I did this for service. I did this to be generous. I was just going to turn it over to Danny Sheehan and let him do with what he wants to do with it. And he said, this is a great idea to get people who are really knowledgeable about this topic together and to have them talk to each other. You get stuff you would never get if you were just trying to interview them. He said, I didn't know half the stuff they were talking about. Let's do a project. And I said, yeah, we can call it Dialogues on Disclosure. And he said, better yet, we'll call it the Disclosure Dialogues. And we clapped hands, we did a high five, we shook hands on it, and that's how the project began.
And that's how your partnership began.
And that's how our partnership began, too. I have a lot of respect and a lot of trust for Ron James. He is a manifester. He's an inventive filmmaker. And he's also, he believes about being in service, especially in service to the people who put their reputations on the line to get out stories which are ridiculed and debunked. And especially people like Steve Bassett, who are bending over backwards to get the American political machine to start to address this issue more seriously. So we decided to align our support with Steve, go to Washington, and shoot his one of his ex-conferences that was at the Press Club. This was the last Press Club conference he did before he did the citizen hearings. So not Ron handled shooting and streaming that, and I handled shooting all the interviews in a hotel room. And we worked on a shoestring again. I mean, I bought two rooms. I put up a backdrop in a room, and I put up lights. I used the TV cameras for, I mean, the TV televisions in the room for monitors, and so we could see what we were doing. And I had them move all the furniture out of the room. They thought, exactly, why are you renting this room? Exactly, what are you doing in here? Mm-hmm. You don't want a bed in here? I said, no, this is going to become a studio. And we shot for a full week. We brought people together who had interesting backgrounds, you know, people from Brazil and people from Russia and people from China and, you know, news media from the D.C. area. And then, you know, Gary Heseltine from England. And, you know, we brought all different people together who had all different backgrounds, and we got them to share their knowledge. And we just said, who do you want to talk to? What do you want to talk about? And then we shot it and we primed him a little bit, but that's what became the basis of the Disclosure Dialogues. And it became an excellent piece. We did it not only into a DVD, but we did it into a 5-DVD set. So you can have all the raw footage and sit through all these interviews if you want, or you can just look at the hour and a half documentary that really Ron created on his own with Chris O'Brien, who came in to help him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, because I know you guys shot a lot of stuff, and it took you many years, right, to get all those interviews together.
Exactly. It was about also a 3-year project. Mm-hmm. You know, the better films take that long to make. You can't do it in a month or two. It just doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Cool stuff, though. I mean, it's you've done now, looking back on it, you've got so much work out there.
Yes. Yes. And Ron's, of course, in L.A. and I'm in Philadelphia. So it's a little tricky, but mm-hmm. it's getting easier and easier to work long distance. You know, we post things on Vimeo. I fly out there. Mostly I've been flying to L.A. certainly to work on the Travis Project. And Ron only came in on the Travis Project just in January. I was out there in the first week of January tweaking this film to finish it, to get it to you by the 15th. And I called Ron up and I said, Ron, you know, I'm in L.A. and I'm working on a film project. He said, you are? Why didn't you tell me? I said, well, I don't know. It's, you know, it's been intense. I've been working hard, but you want to come to the screening. So he showed up and he came to the screening. And it was at that moment that he realized he wanted to be involved in the project. And he wanted to upgrade the project and do more in depth on what happened on board the craft. And then when I returned home, I found out that I wasn't going to be able to use the archive footage. Mm-hmm. And Ron stepped up like a mensch and basically went to the Chase's house and helped me negotiate something so that I could at least festivals, mm-hmm. which is where I'm at now with the footage. But we do have to remake the film, and we have to 86 some of that you know, fabulous footage we have in there from the 1970s and replace it with other footage, which I'm in the process of trying to gain rights for now. Mm-hmm. So
well, we're pretty much out of time, but I'm looking at these pictures, and I'll post a couple of these with the interview at least on the Blog Talk page, and then you know, I'll link to your site from our homepage where the radio show will be. But people can go watch some shorts, trailers that you have out there that are at On Wings Production, and that's ONWINGES Productions.com. You could see a lot of stuff there. Really exciting. I'm now really excited for this new edition. I hope it comes out November, because I'll be there and we'll be able to see that.
Of course, that's my goal, Alejandro, is to show it there at the... So it'll be a premiere of a new film, basically, at the conference.
How fun. That's really exciting. Because I don't get to see the films. You know, it takes forever for me to get to see them. And so I can't remember. It was a while before I got to see, you know, our copy of yours. And it was great. It's just, it is one of the best things out there. You got to talk to so many witnesses, more so than others, and it shot very beautifully. A lot of these interviews outside in the environment or in the areas where these things took place. And
yes.
So it's real exciting.
Great. Well, thank you, Alejandro. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for doing this, and I look forward to doing it again. I'll give you an update on what's happening.
Let's do that. An update, and, you know, as we were talking here, just questions about Travis's case and your experience with talking to people kept coming to mind, and I would love to do a show where we can talk all about that. So we'll get back in touch in a couple months, and we'll do that.
I look forward to it. Blessings to you and everyone at Open Mind. Send my best, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Jennifer Stein for joining us today. Remember, you can see everything that she does at On Wings Production, Productions with an S, and that is spelled O-N-W-I-N-G-E-S, productions.com. The reason I am emphasizing the S is you may not have noticed, but Open Minds is Open Minds Production with no S. Most people have an S, and Jennifer does as well. On Wings Productions. And you'll want to go here because she's got lots of cool stuff. Like she said, you can buy the DVD. That must be kind of new because I didn't know that. I thought you could just see the trailer. So that's pretty cool. And it's well worth it because you'll notice in the trailer, it's just very, very well done, this film. There are also other clips of interviews that you'll be able to see. You'll also be able to see more about her, like her disclosure dialogues that she did with Ron and with Steve Bassett. You can also get a link to the Skyfire Summit there, and that is the Travis Walton 40th anniversary event, which is really exciting. That's something everybody should go check out, like we talked about. You know, you'll be able to, Jennifer will be there, she'll show her film, and hopefully we'll have the latest and the greatest update one. But also, if you go early, it's like the day before the conference starts, you'll be able to go with Travis out to the location during the day, so it's not coldness of the dark, so you could see everything, and then we'll be out there until the sun sets. And I'm going to be emceeing that conference, so really exciting, the 40th anniversary. Go register now, because there is limited seating. There's very limited seating to this event, which is very well priced. It's something like, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 bucks, somewhere around there. I think it's less than $40 at least to go out to the location on a bus, and so it's not dangerous, and then be bused back. And that's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Also there's limited seating for that weekend, which there will be speakers and everything. So you want to get there before they're all sold out. And that's Skyfire Summit. You can Google that, or you can find that at Jennifer Stein's website. So lots of good stuff at Jennifer's website you can check out. There's a lot of good stuff at our website too, openminds.tv. So all of the news that Jason and I talked about will be at openminds.tv. You'll also be able to find some pictures and stories and stuff like that about the Film Festival Awards. In fact, if you go to our YouTube site, which you'll find at openminds.tv, you'll find a video showing the awards and her accepting the awards. She had a long speech that she gave, and it was a lot of fun. So you'll be able to check that out. Travis Walton was also there. So a lot of cool stuff to check out. But openminds.tv, you'll be able to find the stories we talked about and more. Like I said, Roger Marsh has a lot of really cool stories he's written about MUFON sightings that have come in. And those stories are really popular. Some people, I think, used to more than they do now. I think the people who got frustrated that there aren't pictures and videos in many of these stories have finally kind of expressed their frustration with that and are done with it, and now living with the fact that you know what? Not everybody gets a photo or a video if they have a UFO sighting. And many people are interested in hearing about those sightings as well. And like Jason and I talk about often, you know, a lot of times pictures and videos, you can't really tell much from the vast, vast majority, as we've seen. So you need witness testimony. So that testimony is really important. And it actually becomes some of the most important part of the case. So witness testimony alone, I think, is still very interesting. And others agree because Roger's stories about these sightings are very, very popular. Really interesting stuff. So check that out as well. Don't forget, we have that video portal up. And I will let you know that... I do want to address some of the complaints. I mean, there's been a few people who have said, why are you charging for Bob Lazar, man? You should give free. And that would be great, but, you know, it costs thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to put on these events and to get this going and to put these stories up. You know, the guy who does the video here, Michael, myself, and Maureen are full-time staff. And we don't make money at Open Minds. I wish I could say we did, but luckily we have, you know, our investor, our owner, who is really committed to this field, and he's willing to spend money so that we can get this information out and that we can hold these conferences and have these interviews. So all we're trying to do is make up for some of this stuff. And, you know, if we weren't doing that, then we would be so... much out of pocket that it wouldn't be feasible. We couldn't do what we do. And not to toot our horn here, but, you know, I don't know of any other news outlet like Open Minds out there. I mean, we're getting news out there every day. We're putting on these major conferences. We are working extremely hard, not just to put on a conference, but to make it something special. And it was a lot of work, thanks to George Knapp and his help, but it was a lot of work to get Bob Lazar out to come and talk and address people. And I think that's really important. So you're going to be able to see that. And it's just a few dollars, for goodness sakes. In fact, if you register for the month, you get to see the George Knapp video, the Bob Lazar video. You get to see a ton and dozens of other great lectures. Watch them all. Have fun. I mean, a lot of really good information for like $5 or $6 or something like that. So I apologize that we have to charge it. It's frustrating. In an ideal world, perhaps we wouldn't. But then again, we're living in a capitalist country. And you know what? Nothing can exist without making money. Even nonprofits make money. If you look into it, they just, you know, like us, need to spend all their money on what they're doing, which we do, and then some. So we're spending a lot more money. So if anybody should be complaining about having to spend money, it should be us. So, you know, just for those people, you guys are podcast listeners. So you guys are awesome and you don't have these sort of concerns. You all already understand this, because the average intelligence of this podcast listeners, or our podcast listeners, is so high. I mean, I'm going to guess the IQs are somewhere in the 180s, 150s. And the only reason I can tell this is because I meet some of you sometimes at these conferences. And I'm like, you know, every time I meet one of you and say hi, I'm like, wow, that person is an impressive person. That is a super genius. I'm so honored that this person listens to our podcast. So all of you that I've met are very impressive people. So I assume that everybody listening is as well. And I thank you all so much for listening. It's wonderful that we have so many listeners and that the listenership keeps growing and growing. We've almost got 5 million. We've got like 4.5 million listens to our shows. So that is really, really cool. It's so wonderful to get all of this information out. And I love honoring our guests, you know, whether or not we agree on everything, which we mostly don't, which is fine. Who does, you know, in the world? You know, these are wonderful people who I really love and respect for the most part. And they're just people who have a passion for this field, just like I do and you all do. So it's wonderful to be able to get this information out and have people like Jennifer Stein on the show. So it's a heartfelt thank you for listening to the show. And I should give you an update as far as spacing out. You know, Michael, who I talked about, who does our videos, extremely talented young man. I mean, our videos spacing out and everything looks so polished and professional. He's just, I'm just in awe of his abilities. But he's going to China on a trip, so this is really cool. But because he's going to be gone, we're not going to have spacing out for a couple weeks, but we'll be back. And then I'm going on a cruise soon after that, so we probably won't have one that week too. So we'll be hit or miss, but it'll be a couple weeks till we have one. But we do have one that we've posted on Friday, so go check that out. Go check out our YouTube, and you'll see our brand new – or no, we don't. That was 2 weeks ago now that I think about it, because – Maureen and Jason were off with the Mandalorians at this Star Wars thing with hanging with R2 and the Rancor Monster. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, check out their Facebooks and their tweets, and you'll see pictures of those guys having fun. And then Michael and I were looking at video tech stuff in Vegas, so we had a busy week last week. Anyway, we'll have shows back soon. Thank you all so much for listening. Thanks for joining once again. And we will be back soon with another Open Mind UFO Radio. You guys have a great week, and adios, muchachos.